Last two panel discussions we had were really geared towards getting people's feedback on what should, what could or should be in the federal guidance, given constraints, given the constraints of from the perspectives of these field folks who are so fortunate to have with us. And what this map work group was hoping we could do is spend a little time removing yourselves from those constraints as a regulator, as a NGO, as an academic, and try and think a little bit more broadly about what you think could or should be in federal guidance to encourage placement of mitigation where we have the greatest benefit of probability for long-term sustainability. So we're hoping that you can kind of, you know, based on what you've been taking in the past two and almost a half days, spend this last 15 minutes trying to distill down to some of the key points you want them to take back with them when they sit down at the table and start writing this guidance. Eric? Colleen?
So this is definitely not a new point that if anything hasn't been said before, but I just want to repeat it. I think a lot of the successful programs that have happened in the past have been successful because early on there was stakeholder or public input into the process. And that's probably something that hasn't come out in any guidance very strongly in the past was to seek local input into whether to get information or to set priorities.
Early in the process.
So to the extent that this guidance, again, can recommend to the regulatory staff to, in the absence of a formal plan, to seek to communicate and coordinate with others who may have information that would be helpful.
I think the overhead that Eric presented when they were talking about the, now we're calling it the common illness. The thing that he added when they evolved from being steps to these common elements was identification of issues, goals, and objectives at the beginning. And I think a lot of what I was hearing that day was that essential to that is coordination with stakeholders. That's kind of, I mean, I thought that was something that wasn't in it originally that Eric had contributed. I had Colleen, and then Rich, and Suzanne.
Okay. Not filling any of the goals that you brought out there in the beginning, but in my former life had. I'm finding a problem that for the lack of science, and actually since that's one of the desired outcomes, identify or clarify what science says about these issues. And I have to agree with Susan, Marie, and Bob regarding Molly's second page with the keep it as close as you can to the site, and there may very well be reasons why in some areas that's driven. But I think that we really do need to, you know, especially within a watershed context, look at the efficacy of, you know, in-site or on-site, in-kind, even on-site, out-of-kind versus somewhere else in the watershed, because you've got to look at the surrounding land use and the changes to that land use and what functions are you really needing to provide within that watershed. I'm saying that you need to have justification and by science and by looking at it scientifically to basically validation of whether you remain on site or whether you go off site to replace functions. And you may not necessarily be replacing the function that is impacted, because that may be a function that is no longer required, you know, I hate to say that, within the watershed, but if you're looking at an urbanizing area and you know, trying to replace that wildlife function, it may be better to go further up within the watershed where less development is going on, or say further down. So that's, I mean,
what you're saying.
And from dealing with that,
making that 15 years away from on-site and kind to be questioned kind of
about. No, I'm not saying anything about making. I'm saying that there's got to be scientific validation on the decisions that lead you to either remain on-site or move off-site and replace whichever function that is needed within that watershed in the context of the landscape use issue or basis.
I've got Rich, Suzanne, and Molly.
guidance that's developed can be organized around the framework that Eric presented. I think it's a matter of embellishing and fleshing out each of these steps. But I think as people were talking, it's able to almost take ideas and notions and concepts, and each one could find its home in this framework. So that's a way of organizing this down the road. That's not bad. That's a good framework. Well, it has helped, at least for me, for the last 3 days.
Thank you.
Suzanne and Molly. I guess I just want to do what you did, Eric, and reiterate something that's already been said, which is I think we should be very careful not to lose sight of the purpose of the program, which is within the purpose and the goals of the Clean Water Act. And we shouldn't be creating barriers to achieving the goals of the Clean Water Act. And we should, you know, this gets also to the integration of existing programs. We've heard that you're moving over to the TMDL unit. You know, I mean, you know, there's a great fit there. Compensatory mitigation can get streams off of the 303D list. You know, we really need to think more about breaking down barriers that have been built with these programs that are an outgrowth of the Clean Water Act. Molly?
I need a few things. One is to add consultants to the list of people. We use the word science, you use the word scientific and so on, and in our agreement anyway, the consultants are the ones who know what's going on the ground. So in terms of daily permit, and by the way, the purpose of the program is issuing permits. In one sense, get those permits out the door. So scientific, it generally things that are scientific studies in the purer sense don't ever make it to regulatory arena in general. They could if there was a plan, it could be fed into that, but just on a daily basis, it's not there. But the consultants are there all the time, and so they have a lot of experience in what works, what doesn't work. They're the ones who are going to actually do the sort of the studies of what's in the relevant area that the applicant is willing to pay for, and that we can within our realm of asking for. And so the other thing, the going out of kind and all that stuff based on scientific information, it's hard because we don't necessarily have the science available on a daily basis.
Well, are you proposing a way of incorporating the consultant's point of view? I mean,
when you talk about coordination, they should be part of it.
They should be, okay.
Not just federal agencies. Okay, that's Richard and Josh.
One possible solution in Washington State, we've used independent science panels as a way of kind of bridging that gap. Some consultants are really good, others are very permit focused. And so when we're looking at developing plans for compensatory mitigation, it seems to be a great idea to have some type of an independent science review panel that can continually bring the academic world into the real planning and implementation world.
And our committee has both. I was no one has mentioned the MBRTs at all. I mean, that's
a fairly conference, isn't it?
But they're doing this stuff.
But the whole idea of that being any kind of a framework for this, you know, coordination goal. I mean, I know that they're limited. They don't usually include as many maybe partners as we've talked about, but I'm surprised nobody has even just talked about the benefits having that structure as broader.
We keep hearing how long they take.
It's a mitigation bank plan.
Right, no, I know. Oh, yeah, I know. But it's the people sitting around the table. Jeff?
I just have one about that.
You're not old enough for that.
Not the years, it's the mileage.
One thing with the mitigation. Oh, no, it was. Mitigation. That is a good mechanism that works well. Basically says you should use that MBRT model for any in-loop feed programs, and that's probably a good way to go with that. Some of this watershed stuff may end up being, in essence, in-loop feed programs, for endangered species is we use recovery teams. The purpose of a recovery team is to assemble all the best experts there are about that species or that group of species. They're only advisory to us. We don't have to do what they say.
We still make the final decisions. But maybe that's another model that could be used as the recovery teams.
Josh?
Last night at the award ceremony, one of the recipients, the woman who received the award for wetland community leadership, found out why I was really in Washington. It wasn't just to see her. She's a friend. And she said that today I ought to ask the question, not requiring an answer probably. But when I said we're trying to look at mitigation in a watershed context, her first response was not, oh good, it was, is this going to lead to more avoidance? So I think it goes back to what Suzanne was talking about. You know, is this mechanism of seeing mitigation in a watershed context going to make it easier not to avoid destroying wetlands someplace else? It was just a concern to me.
So Mark made a kind of similar comment today about speaking at the Aliava conference, and he started talking about mitigation, and everyone said, you know, assume that they all understood that he that Matt was talking about mitigation with sequencing of avoidance and minimization coming through.
I'll just point out that in Florida, we've got so many mitigation banks and so many credits available that I get a little scared sometimes that the bankers may be out there in collusion with the developers to I mean, I bet huh? Well, so I think it's a valid concern. I'm not concerned. I mean, I think those bankers want to use up those, I mean, they want to sell those credits.
Yeah. Yeah. That's their property.
A process in our area, I think, that's gotten ahead of regulatory quite a bit, and it is this, and it's met with a lot of success for a variety of reasons, but there's been a big push towards acquisition of properties into public ownership, and there's strategies for that, for wildlife corridors, well field protection, and all of that. Those lands that are being purchased are wetlands and uplands and scrub and matrix of areas, and there's been tremendous buy-in politically and stakeholders and stuff to make that happen. And those lands have really brought a lot of opportunity, I think, for restoration and improvements. You know, a lot of those lands have come with baggage and things. And I think in our area, that's been real successful, but regulatory hasn't caught up with the idea of pushing people in that direction to contribute to those restoration efforts or additional land acquisitions to fill in the gaps and pieces of these corridors and things like that. And I've come from regulatory, and now I'm out of it. And I think for the things that I saw that we permitted that remained on private lands or for a variety of reasons either weren't or weren't successful, whether they're going to be properly managed forever and that sort of thing, are going to be lost where there will be a lot more comfort level, I think, in those places where it's on public lands that these things occurred, and money and people and other things are in place to see success for the restoration and long-term management for those kinds of things. So I just see that is one real shining area, particularly in our area, that we're going to be able to recover and maintain some of those resources. And I hope that this process provides some of that encouragement to go there.
Yeah,
I'd like to just reinforce what you say, because I think we sort of need to leave the avoidance thing in there so they don't just cut right to paying somebody to do their mitigation. But there's certainly a lot of places where avoidance is ecologically stupid, if you will, and we don't want to make them still go in that box and preserve something that won't be managed. And I think another maybe point that needs to be on our golden nuggets is what Eric said earlier, that it has to be managed. We have to have mechanisms to be sure the things we do are managed in perpetuity. We're already finding that our mitigation banks, and we have the first private bank in the nation, they managed it very intensively to meet all our strictest performance standards, and it was a spectacular success. They've turned it over to a public land management agency. It happens to be the park district I live in. It's already reverting and degrading because they do not have the funds to manage it that intensively.
Molly?
And I'd like to, since Fish and Wildlife Service is in the room, I would like to urge Fish and Wildlife Service in particular to think about being a little more flexible in the concept that you can't do anything to help Fish and Wildlife Service on lands they already own as mitigation, because there are areas where there's not enough money to manage or there's not enough money to do projects, and sometimes we have mitigation, we have impacts in areas that suggest that the most obvious thing to do would be to do a certain thing. I don't mean just throw money at the service, but there are certain things that everybody knows that they need to do and they don't have any money to do it, and the service won't.
That's
not
refugees.
That's right. Eric and John.
How
refreshing.
I'd like to echo something I think that Josh had said, that maybe potentially one of the biggest benefits would be if you could go, you know, to every watershed and just compile some core set of maps or information. You know, and Josh, you tick them off, you know. So that information, that sort of, whether it's a clearinghouse or, you know, a website with all the links, but basically...
The federal agencies would have time to correct.
Exactly. The federal agencies could come supply for all of their field offices. You know, you can pull up your watershed and you can get, you know, land use, land cover, you know, hydrography, you know, anything historic, you know, just the basic data sets that are out there and make it easy to access. That would probably go a long way to helping people think in a watershed perspective. It's just having that data where they don't have to spend 2 weeks trying to find it, but it's readily accessible.
I think Mark's going to address this actually in his closing statements. John?
I want to, Molly, be careful about using mitigation funds to mitigate on public land or fish and wildlife land, because I mean, first of all, we have the guidance in the mitigation, you know, in the mitigation stuff about not supplanting, and we've had situations. Well, you can ignore it, but we've had situations in Florida where we've actually had bankers come in and argue with our district engineer that they needed the credits from a Corps of Engineers restoration project, and we just can't go there. So we have to be very, very careful.